Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond.
And I'm Claudia Wu. We're the founders of Cherry Bomb Magazine. This season on Radio Cherry Bomb, we're thrilled to share recordings from the Cherry Bomb Jubilee. It took place Sunday, March 29th, 2015, in Manhattan.
This was the second annual Jubilee, which is a one-day conference with some of the most amazing, inspiring women in and around the world of food.
This next segment was the keynote conversation between Chef April Bloomfield of the famous Spotted Pig in New York and Gail Simmons of Top Chef. The introduction was provided by Mimi Sheraton, the legendary journalist, author, and restaurant critic.
April is one of the most important female chefs, not just in this country, but on the planet. So it was amazing to hear about her brilliant career. April's a pretty modest person, and she turned red when Mimi introduced her. I think she might have had tears in her eyes, too.
Enjoy the conversation, and thanks for listening to this special episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Sheraton. I ought to quit while I'm ahead and step down right now, but I think I would rather talk about the extraordinary woman chef April Bloomfield. I am an enormous fan of her restaurants and her food. And when I was doing my book, which I'll give a small plug, though it all just sold out, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and I was looking for a source for everything in the book. And when it came to Coco Van, the only thing I thought about was the Breslin, because April does an epic Coco Van, which has to be ordered in advance and then is made with a real rooster, who comes with his head and his coxcomb, and it's a totally fantastic dish. As many of you know, April was born in Birmingham, England, and fortunately came to New York City. I sort of think it's England's way of thanking us for Lend-Lease before World War II, if anyone remembers World War II as well as I do. She wanted to be a cop, of all things, and then went straight and decided to be a chef. She now holds forth over marvelous restaurants in New York, Breslin, John Dory, which I loved in its original home on 10th Avenue near 15th. It was small. I don't know if any of you saw it. It was lined in gorgeous shell mosaics and exotic fish tanks. But I think it was too small to accommodate all of her fans. Spotted Pig, Salvation Taco, all in New York, and in San Francisco, Tosca, which makes me wonder if it's food to eat before you jump off the top of Castle Sant'Angelo in Rome from the opera of the same name. She wrote a wonderful book, A Girl and Her Pig, which had all of her lusty, marvelous food, great instructions for doing it. What I love about her food is that though it looks innovative and it's full of ideas, almost every single dish is rooted in tradition. So you don't feel on another planet while you're eating it. It has a natural comfort to it. Her new book, about to be released, I think, in a few days, A Girl in Her Greens, is probably nose-to-tail vegetables. Because if anybody can make vegetables totally satisfying and probably make you not miss meat, it would be April. She is very much like her food, straightforward, honest, joyous, comforting, charming, and absolutely, totally delicious. So I think I will save time and we can listen to the versatile Gail Simmons introduce the wonderful April Bloomfield.
Hi, guys. Wow, I was almost brought to tears. I'm not quite sure what to say. I'm very humbled.
I'm pausing only because what's sitting across from you right now, in this moment, staring out at this beautiful, extraordinary room, after that introduction, it occurs to me that you find yourself here. And that must be overwhelming. I know it's a joy for all of us because you have, I could give Ken a little credit, but mostly going to say you have single-handedly changed the way we eat in New York and certainly in America. But it didn't start out that way, and here we are. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's go back and start a little bit at the beginning. I don't want to spend all our time talking about the beginning because I really want to spend most of our time talking about the now. And Mimi mentioned a few things that I thought would be interesting to hear about. The first of which is that you wanted to be a cop.
Yes, it sounds strange, but I was completely obsessed with Cagney and Lacey growing up. We had a program in England called Juliet Bravo, and I was slightly obsessed with her too. You know, I was really drawn to those kind of strong woman police characters on the TV shows in the 70s and 80s. So that was where that kind of stemmed from.
And the uniform.
And the uniform.
It was a good uniform.
Yeah, and I also really liked the, I liked the kind of the hierarchy. I kind of liked the idea of the order and the rules that you have to have. Sometimes they don't stick to the rules, as I've learned. but yeah, so, you know, it was something I really, really wanted to do.
So why didn't you?
I procrastinated. I sent my application form off. I was 16 years old, and actually I was about to turn 16. And I was probably a wee bit too apprehensive and didn't send my application form off. I got an application back saying, sorry, you have to try when you're 18. So I needed something to fall back on. So the other strong women in my family were my two sisters, and they were both at cooking school at the time. So my mom sat me down, and she's like, okay, darling, what are you going to do? You know, you've got 3 weeks till you leave school. You know, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. And my sister walked in. She was wearing her chef uniform at the time. And I was kind of like, I kind of like that uniform. I'll do that.
Not quite as sexy as the cop uniform. But
not as sassy. But, you know, when I got to cooking school, I really enjoyed it. I just loved the smell in the kitchen. You know, I remember walking into an ethnic kitchen that we called it at school at the time. It had a tandoor, it had woks. You know, you could smell all the spices. It was really inviting, and it was buzzy and bustling, and everybody was working together. And I really, really was very drawn to that. And it kind of had those underlying layers, pretty similar to being in the police force, like a sense of community, working for a community.
Sure. And I think there's also obviously very overall similarities in the structure of the brigade, of the the military structure,
sure, yeah, exactly.
And the kitchen structure. Yeah. And so you decided to cook. You were in Birmingham. What were you eating at home at the time? What were sort of your early memories of food that excited you, that you think about now? Because I believe, and I'm sure we all can associate those early memories that form so much of our palate, the way we cook, the way that we eat.
Well, I mean, my grandmother was an amazing cook. I just have very, very fond memories of being in her house on a Sunday with, Frank Sinatra or, you know, some old crooner singing on the radio. With a pork roast in the oven, and you could smell the sweet pork, and when it come out, you could see the salt crust on top. You know, she was really organized. She'd have all her mise en place, which I didn't know was mise en place at the time, all on the stove ready to cook, so when the roast come out, she could let it rest and cook everything else. And I just remember those steamy windows and that kind of general sense of warmth. and happiness.
So after culinary school, then you started cooking in kitchens, in professional kitchens. Did they provide the same warmth and happiness?
It was a little more stressful. but it was still inviting. Although I didn't want to cook at the time, and I didn't realize I would be as passionate, I walked into the kitchen and I looked in and saw everybody cooking, and I just told myself, this is not what I want to do right now, but I'm going to give my time here 110%. And that's what I did, and I didn't look back. And actually, we were in a group, and we all have to say our names, and it's like my worst nightmare. So being up here is pretty terrible too.
Sorry.
Right now. but this woman stood up, and she said her name, and she was like, I don't want to be here. And I'm like, that's really frustrating. Like, I don't want to be here, but I'm giving myself a chance to make this work, you know. Like, I've got a chance to learn and be good at something. And I wasn't so blasé about my time there, you know.
So when in the process did it become clear that this was, or maybe you still don't want to be here and you can leave if you want, we'll find, no. where in the process did it click? Did you decide, I'm actually good at this and I think I'm going to stick with it?
I was cooking a long time until I realized it clicked. I really enjoyed my jobs, but when it really clicked was going to the River Cafe in London and working next to Rose and Ruth, who were the owners. It really, something just connected with me there.
But there were years in between.
There was years in between.
Of many kitchens.
Right. And I really just kept pushing myself every day. And I was happy in moments. But after the 10 years of cooking at that stage, I was a little disheartened. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to try and reapply for the police force just to see if I should be doing that and not cooking. You know, you got to give it a go, right? So I reapplied for I got another application. And I was like, okay, I'm going to fill it out. But if something goes wrong, it's just not meant to be. So an application form came back, and it was for transport police. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. I'm like, so I'm meant to be cooking. And so that's when I really just took the bull by its horns and ran with it, really.
The restaurants you cooked in before the River Cafe were very different in their style.
Mm-hmm.
Would you call them, do you want to describe a little bit about the chefs you worked for? Kensington Place, the Brackenberry, Bibendum. I wouldn't necessarily, would you call them gastro pubs? They were gastro restaurants.
They were they coined themselves modern European or modern British. Rolly Lee, I worked with him at Kensington Place. It was a really great restaurant for its time. It opened in 1987 alongside many other amazing restaurants at that time. And it was very simple. It was a piece of fish with some lentils and some salsa verde. You know, it was the hardest chicken mousse you could ever imagine making that looked really simple, but it was really complicated. But, you know, just amazing food. And we did a ton of covers there, and it really taught me how to be consistent. And I think that's a really good tool to have when you cook. You know, if you're not consistent, then people are not going to want to come back.
So you learned consistency. That was a high-volume restaurant.
Yeah.
Bibendum was smaller.
Yeah.
What did you learn there?
Well, that was more of a French-style kitchen. But, you know, that had its challenges, too. You know, it was a little bit more refined. So I had to learn that side of it. I had to push myself. You know, the scary thing was I was just about to turn 20, and they told me I'd have to come up with a menu for lunch. I was like 20. I was like, I have to come up with a menu? It's petrifying. You know, I used to go into work every day, and I was worried. I was stressed, you know. But I used to ask around and ask people for help, and I'd be like, hey, what did you do when you were on this station? And they would tell me, and maybe I'd try their recipe. And, you know, when I got up, plucked up my courage, I'd kind of do my recipe, you know.
Was that the first time that a chef gave you that sort of responsibility?
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting it. I knew Simon Hopkinson, who owned Bibendum, and I didn't know that part of it going in, and I'm glad, because I probably wouldn't have taken the job. But it really gave me the tools to just be put in a stressful situation and just really push through the pain, you know. And I didn't realize until a long time had passed that was a really good tool to have.
Mm-hmm. And then you ended your time in England, for now, at the River Cafe.
Yeah.
That was a totally different kitchen, a legendary kitchen, still is, run by two extraordinary women who led their kitchen in a very different way. What was the major difference that you saw between their kitchen, their style of cooking, but also their style of managing their team?
They were just very much more relaxed in general, Rose and Ruth, and much more fun to work for. They were just very passionate. They would go to Italy on trips. They would take, you know, the chefs there. We would all taste. They would come back and just recreate whatever they'd eaten in Italy and transform it into something spectacular. And I'd never worked with anybody before that had done that with the palate, you know. You know, with that kind of bright acidity, salty, complex, you know, just amazing women to work for.
And then an opportunity came many years later. You were at River Cafe for many years.
They were 4 years, the best 4 years of my life. If I hadn't got a job, actually, at the River Cafe, you know, I don't know what I would be doing now. So I'm very forever indebted to Ruthie Rogers and the late Rose Gray.
Did you, at that point, when you were cooking for them, think about America, think about coming here or cooking here? Was that something that interested you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, secretly, it was my dream to be NYPD.
There's still hope.
So, there's still hope. I wanted to basically eat donuts and drive a cop car, basically. I eat lots of donuts. I just don't drive. Anyway, I forgot the question now. I got all excited.
I don't know. It was about coming to America. I guess, you know, so you're cooking at the River Cafe, the epicenter of the culinary world at that moment in London, in England. You were a sous chef by then.
Yes, yeah.
And you decided to leave and come to the States.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do that? That's a big move at a pivotal moment.
Yeah, I mean, I could have still been at the River Cafe. I mean, it was such an amazing place to work. But I got offered this opportunity, and I feel like I've always lived my life very openly and kind of always just been flexible. And I think that's created a lot of opportunities in my life. I haven't planned very much. So I got this opportunity through Ken Friedman and Jamie Oliver to come and open a gastro pub in New York. And at the time, I kind of was, you know, when Ken and Jamie called me, I was like, yeah, you know, we'll figure it out. I was quite blasé about the whole thing. And I was like, who's Mario Batali? Had no idea. But I was ready for a life change. I wanted to change my life. I wanted to go where I could start fresh and eat different food, meet different people, and just experience life. So that's why I basically took the job in New York.
And what excited you that you got to taste when you arrived?
Well, yes, I went on a whirlwind weekend with Mario Batali and Ken Friedman.
So you guys know how that goes.
It was
those
rather,
benders.
It was rather epic, I have to say. We went to Lupa and Babbo at the time. We went to Pearl Oyster Bar. We went to Union Square Cafe. I've had my first tuna burger. It was pretty epic.
And they convinced you somehow.
Yeah, exactly. We actually, the story goes, we were all having lunch at Pearl Oyster Bar, and I had the most huge fish sandwich you can ever imagine from Rebecca. And apparently Mario said to Ken, if she's the one, I'll give you a thumbs up or thumbs down. And apparently they did that behind my back. So I think I got a thumbs up, which was really good.
Good move, Ken Freeman and Mario Batali. And they wanted you to open a gastro pub. That was their words. That was their vision.
Yes, yep. Ken wanted to kind of have a place where he could hang out and have this amazing thing that the English have, which is basically a really top-notch pub. When I got offered the job, I really wasn't into opening a gastropub because, you know, my background was restaurants. But I was kind of like, you know, it's an opportunity. I'm going to roll with it. But what I'm not going to do is do classic gastropub food. I'm going to do restaurant quality food in a casual setting. And that combination with Ken's vision and my vision just, you know, kind of made something really special and you know, it's phenomenal just to see 11 years in that we're still open and, you know, very humble and going strong.
You're definitely open. There are a lot of people in the Spotted Pig at all hours of the day and night. And thank goodness your food is everything but ordinary pub food. And it was a moment in New York that when you did open that you did something people had never done before. I don't know if New York could put their finger on at the time or knew what kind of precedent you were setting. Did you know at the time that this was something people were craving as much as they were? What was that? What do you accredit that little magic to?
I didn't have any idea. I just knew that I wanted to cook the food that I really wanted to cook. I wanted to cook tasty food, soulful food, things that just kind of like give you a big hug when you eat them. You know, they really satisfy the soul. I'm all about that food that gives you that, wow, that's really effing delicious. You know, like what is going on? Mm-hmm. You know, and having those moments where you kind of, you have this connection with the food and it's not cerebral, it's all soul, all the way. I love it.
You say a lot in your books and when we talk about the food you like best being simple, but that doesn't mean it's easy, that it's all about the details.
Right, right.
The little moments within a dish. And I think that's very much what we all think of when we think of your food. The little twist of unexpected. Are there favorite dishes that have made it all the way through? I mean, there are some iconic dishes on that menu. Were they there in Ken's vision? Were they... Did you see eye to eye at the very beginning about some of them?
Well, Ken and I had different visions. You know, Ken had, you know, already previously written his business plan. So when I hadn't moved yet, but I was in England, I just got my computer and Ken sent me an email. Emails were very new to me. And he sent me his business plan and he sent me a mock menu and it was tofu hot dogs and kosher burgers. And I was like, damn. I sent him an email. I'm like, I think you got the wrong person. But as soon as I sent my menu back of just all the things that I was passionate about, he really got it. And that's what's really, you know, special about our relationship. He really does just kind of, we trust each other, which is amazing.
I think that is something we all strive for in collaboration in our work.
Yeah.
Finding a partner who... trusts you to do what you do best. What do you look for now that you have expanded? I'm skipping a little, but we're going to go back. With your partners, your team, the people that you're hiring, what are some of the most important qualities that you look for in the people you surround yourself with at the restaurant?
There's many. I mean, passion for one. People that talk about food are really into food. You know, drive. Good work ethic, integrity, you know, all those things kind of come into play. You know, usually they have to take direction really well and pay attention. The details are what make you successful. You know, you really need to hone in on those. So people, I like to see that their attention to detail. You know, when people work closely with me, it's like we're on the same page. You know.
Do you think you're a hard boss to work for?
I think I'm firm, but I feel like I'm very fair. I always give people chances, more than probably sometimes they should have. But, you know, yeah, I'm fair. I feel like I'm a fair boss, but firm.
And what about the differences between the kitchens that you work in England mm-hmm. and kitchens here? Do you think that there's a major difference in the way that kitchens are run?
I think the setup of lunch and dinner are different. In England, the chef usually is still very responsible for his or her own section. And I think in New York, it's got a bit of a twist where you get a lot of the prep done by the prep guys and then the chefs come in a little later. But I think that's merely down to wage, you know, wage and hourly pay.
Does it work differently in England that you're...
Yeah, you usually come in, you know, first thing in the morning and you get your list,
you
get your menu, you sit down with a chef, this is what you got to do today, and then you just kind of... you know, make this magnificent mise en place, and that you know, it's like your box is full of this amazing food and you're like ready for service, you're like going into war and you're all set up. It's like a really great feeling.
Do you still get to do a little of that from time to time?
I still like to be present in my kitchens. I love to cook. You know, I like to get stuck in. I'm fairly, you know, pretty much all the time just close to my chef's plating. You know, you don't want to see your chefs in a shit. You're not going to sit there or stand there and just watch them go down. I'm like right there with them. Yeah.
So how do you do that now that you have the Spotted Pig, the John Dory, the Breslin, Tosca Cafe? I mean, I think this is the question that everyone gets asked and is always difficult to explain. How do you split your time when there are now so many people demanding your time, both in the restaurants and out?
Well, I think Uber is my biggest... I'm Uber's biggest client, I think, because I do a lot of running around. I do a lot of restaurant hopping, a lot of phone calls. I taste all the time. I just run. I'm like a little mouse. I run. I keep running. I don't stop.
And how has your team changed since... you have so many restaurants too. What does that require of the people who work for you?
It's good. It gives everybody else a certain amount of responsibility, and I think it's good for them. It's good to see them grow and see what they're capable of. You know, they kind of blossom into wonderful flowers, and you get to kind of, you know, push them up, and you're like partly responsible for kind of like, you know, making them into amazing chefs, you know. But I have a great support staff. All my chefs in my restaurants are super strong. They've been with me for a very long time. I like to look after them. You know, I constantly walk around and I see and talk to all my staff, whether they're, you know, just new line cooks or old line cooks. You know, and I try and build this relationship and hopefully, you know, they'll be with you for a very long time. And you know, one day they'll, you know, blossom and open their own restaurant. Josh even is a very classic example. Josh is now my chef partner at Tosca Cafe in San Francisco, and he has been with me for 7 years, and he definitely has that little something, and he's put in his time, and so it was nice to be able to give back to Josh and give him a restaurant of his own.
It's rare, especially in professional kitchens. I mean, it's rare anywhere these days in any industry, I think, to stay in one job for that long. But restaurants are notoriously high in turnover for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. So in retaining staff, do you feel a pressure to keep opening restaurants to give them more opportunity? Do you find that, is that a motivation that you think about a lot?
Sometimes, yeah, but not all the time. It's purely for my own creativity. you know, I can do things at, I can't do things at the Spotted Pig that I can do at the John Dory. And so the John Dory kind of stemmed out of that. You know, the pig kitchen's very hot, it's very sweaty, tiny, you know, so to be able to cook more fish, you know, that's the reason we opened the John Dory, so... did that answer your question?
Yeah, that totally answered my question. Thank you. And what about where you find inspiration? We work in a city where very few kitchens have windows, and you work very long hours. How do you get out and not fall into the trap of the windowless life in New York City?
Well, I mean, my inspiration comes from all over, my friends, people that I talk to, my coworkers, you know, even my chefs, you know, just talking to them on a daily basis. You know, going out to eat, I read, going to, you know, just traveling upstate and, you know, stopping at a farmer's market and buying an abundance of food and going back and cooking with it, you know, all that stuff kind of gets your juices flowing and kind of inspires you, you know. Just seeing beauty every day, like beautiful vegetables at the market, or like a stunning piece of meat in a meat locker or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you get to cook these days at home? Not obviously in the kitchen, but do you get to spend some time cooking at home?
I do, yeah. When I cook at home, I cook just regular stuff. I do roast.
What's April Bloomfield regular stuff?
You know, like if I want something comforting, I'll cook like a roast chicken with roast potatoes and lots of greens, you know, salads, pastas, all that delicious stuff.
Is there ingredients or dishes you miss from home that you don't get to eat here?
Yeah, you know, we have this thing called kippers, which is basically a split fish that's usually like a sprat or something, and it's smoked and it gets really salty and umami, you know, it's like salty and sweet, and you just have it for breakfast. Anyway, it's so full of flavor and so amazing. I miss those. I wish we could have those here, but
maybe,
you know,
we need a British Fish Smokehouse by April Bloomfield.
Yeah.
That sounds really appealing, actually, right now. And now your world is not just restaurants. With the work that you do, books have come out of them. A Girl and Her Pig, which is your homage to meat.
Yeah.
And the people who taught you to cook it.
Yes, yeah.
And your second book, which I am very lucky to have a galley of right here, A Girl and Her Greens. In reading the book, and I don't want to get this wrong, so I'm going to quote a sentence that I read in the middle of your book, which I thought was very telling and would love you to expand on. In talking about why you are doing a book about vegetables when you're so known for your meat cookery, you say, "My motivation is more about passion than scruples. I'm not trying to make a big statement. I just love the way boiled broccoli rabe sort of bites the back of your mouth." So tell me about vegetables and why this moment with vegetables.
You know, I mean, everybody, you know, probably thinks of me as nose to tail, you know, using everything ethos. And I think a lot of people don't know that I love vegetables. I think they're the most versatile things. You can substitute them for meat, and they can still have the same texture and flavor. You know, they give off different qualities when you have them raw, to cooked, to a little more cooked, to you know, all those things. I love every vegetable.
Are you excited to show people a different side of yourself in this book? What are we going to find in here that we didn't know about April?
I mean, this is not a vegan book, by the way, just so we know. There is a little bit of meat in some of these vegetables, a little bit of cream, anchovy, you know, but they're not, all those kind of flavors are not there to mask the vegetable. They're there to kind of fortify the vegetable. Every dish in this book is balanced, and it really showcases what you can do with the vegetable.
So if I'm going to take this book home tonight, which I will, what's the recipe I should make from it tonight for dinner?
Well, if you like fennel,
I do like fennel.
There's a fennel and potato gratin in there with anchovies and cream. You know,
my mother-in-law's here. Can we make that tonight for dinner?
It's not. Okay. It's not too much cream that it takes away from the fennel, but so it's really delicate and beautiful. And actually, the texture of the fennel is just very melting, and you know, it's just like you can put a spoon through it, and it's just velvety and sweet and slightly anisey. Which is amazing.
That sounds really good. I think what's interesting about your recipes in this book and in your first book that struck me and that you talk about is that you don't simplify them. This is not necessarily a book of how to cook my food as easily in under 6 minutes as possible book. You don't... you're not writing the book to take shortcuts necessarily, and
no.
In some cases the recipes can appear quite complex.
Right.
Are you worried about that in terms of the home cook making them?
No, I really wanted to kind of aim this book mostly at the home cook, but that would be still interesting for professional chefs. And I think that's where all that flavor comes from. You know, it's not just a simple recipe. It's they're all very approachable, and I really wanted to make that a point of the book, because a lot of people are really just, I mean, hands up, how many people are scared of cooking vegetables? I mean, they can be terrifying, you know. But when I was at cooking school, you know, green beans terrified the life out of me. I was like, I get cold sweats just trying to like prep them and know that
because
I have to
put them in. Because you're scared of overcooking them? Because you're scared of what's the fear?
Exactly. But, you know, there's two ways of cooking a green bean. Actually, you can eat them raw, which are really delicious. You can have them with Parmesan cheese and some salad, you know, a little bit of sea salt. You can have them the French way, where they're just kind of in and out, and they're a little al dente, you know, a little kind of crunchy, you know. And then you can have the Italian way, where they're really stewed for a long time, and they all have, like, these different kind of nuances the more you cook them. And I think I wanted to show that in the book, that they're very versatile.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of recipes actually in the book that talk about the same ingredient in many different ways within a recipe as well, which I think
yes,
is very
like
telling.
Yes, like the fennel salad. In the book, I have a roasted fennel two ways, a roasted fennel and raw fennel salad. So you really kind of get the two textures. You get the nice velvety, silky fennel, and then you get this really crisp, strong anise flavor. And they just kind of complement each other, you know. That's with some blood orange and bataga.
I think it's the little nuances of your food that we're all so drawn to. I know that your use of those moments of acidity and saltiness, the anchovy, the bataga, the lemon, and as you say, they're not there to mask, but to heighten.
Yeah.
Find balance.
To fortify, yeah. To bring them to life and there's some simple recipes in. Don't be scared. There's some simple recipes in there. You know, again, like having some nice light boiled broccoli with some olive oil and salt is the most heavenly thing in the world.
So how do you, in your own life with all your restaurants, find a little bit of balance? What do you do to escape at the end of a day, besides drink heavily?
You know, I want to talk about that a little bit. I think I've been cooking a very long time, and I wish I had somebody, or a mentor or a chef. I mean, Ruthie did it a little bit. She would always make me go on vacation. But I really wish I had more responsible chefs that could kind of teach you how to balance. And I think, Tanya, you mentioned it earlier. I don't know where. Oh, there you are. That really could help me, you know, not waste my time by drinking too much or partying or doing all these crazy stuff, you know, or stretching and teaching you how to look after your body in the kitchen. Because being 40 now, you know, I kind of feel like I'm 60. So, you know, just kind of having those opportunities. And I'm definitely on the same page with you, Tanya, that I think I'm just going to try and help my staff. You know, I always try and say, look, you've got to take time off. But, you know, they only hear you so much, you know. So I'm going to keep plugging at that and try and lead by example. Yeah, I go for walks. I cook. I like to listen to the birds. I like to be out in the open. I like fishing. I fish with Anita and Elizabeth on a regular basis. All those things really just kind of keep me grounded and happy.
When a young cook is starting their career, and I say young cook, but it could be really anyone who's at the beginning of their career, where the pressure to put your head down and focus and work an 18-hour day, because that's what everyone else is doing, and that's what you need to do in the kitchen, because that's what the job entails. How do you tell someone, I need to take a vacation?
Well, I mean, you know, it's good to take vacation because you can keep plowing, right? But you can only do it for so long. Like, you have to find balance. I've done it. I've been there. But now I'm paying the price, right? But you know, you just take your days off when you take your days off, you know. And if you're feeling good, then pick up an extra shift and do the work. But, like, try and find the balance. Don't, you know, don't be, like, balls to the wall, like, the whole time, you know.
Yeah.
Smell the roses a little bit, you know.
A hard thing to do, especially when they won't bloom in this miserable winter. But we're getting there. There is sunlight. I am convinced that we will see spring in the market.
Yes. Fingers crossed.
Right.
So a few weeks left, I think. Yeah.
So what are you excited about for spring?
Oh, you know,
what's new for spring this year?
Yeah, you know, I'm always excited about those ramps coming, you know. I think fiddlehead ferns are already here. Ramps are next. Peas, you know. I'm a big fan of peas, so...
You have to be. Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's part of your cliche.
Well, you know, they're called English peas for a reason, so... Mm-hmm.
They're sweet and beautiful. So if spring... I mean, we've talked about spring renewal... what gets you excited about cooking in every season? How do you face the beginning of winter and be re-inspired? Where do you find new foods to cook, or how do you face a season again?
Well, my favorite seasons are spring and fall, just because I think they're very on the other end of the spectrum, you know, kind of, you know... I like the first greens that come in, because you get really excited. You've kind of been starved of green for like, you know, a good couple of months, 3 months. And so it's really exciting to get that. And then, you know, like the long, hot summer, it's good. Summer's great. You know, you can kind of eat a bit lighter. You grill outside if you have a grill. But then fall comes, and then the frost comes, and it's kind of a more extreme, isn't it? So I love that. I love fall. I love the frost, you know, that kind of hits the pumpkin and makes them sweeter, or hits the broccoli rabe and makes it sweeter, you know. I love fall, winter, you know. I like fall better, but sometimes winter drags on, as we all know. Mm-hmm.
Did you anticipate these? This is an off, sort of unrelated, but did you anticipate coming here? How long and deep the winter may be?
No. No, it doesn't snow in England anymore, just so you know. No, but I love the snow. I really do. I was upstate on Saturday, and I saw the sun, the snow coming down. On, you know, I'm like a little kid. I'm like, woo, snow! It's great, it's so great. And then you're like, but green.
This is backtracking, but it's a question I meant to ask a few minutes ago. When you came here and opened the Spotted Pig, the original restaurant, what surprised you the most in the process of opening a restaurant yourself for the first time? Not someone else's vision,
right.
Not being the chef under another chef, or the chef de partie or the chef de cuisine. What?
I tell you what surprised me the most, and I think it surprised Ken just as much as me, that we forgot to order the plates.
Plates are important in a restaurant. Note... Everyone, scribble that down. Plates.
No, remember to order the plates, seriously. No, it was like 2 weeks before or a week before we were due to open. And I said to Ken, I said, oh, did you order the plates? He's like, no, I thought you ordered the plates. So just as the customers were coming through the door, the plates were coming at the same time. So we were like desperately trying to open the boxes and put them through the dishwasher. But anyway.
Was opening... When you first opened the hut, was it how you envisioned it? Did it go more or less the way you thought, or were there challenges that you couldn't have foreseen?
I think my main challenges was managing people. You know, I was very young. I got to New York when I was 27. It probably wasn't the ideal time for me to manage people. So,
Why do you say that?
Well, just because I was young and I didn't have the skills, I think. And so, you know, I had a big struggle with that at the beginning. But as I get older and I've been through it more, I think it's becoming a lot more easy and consistent.
What are some of the skills that you came to appreciate that you probably didn't appreciate then in managing people? Because I also think that's the hardest part of any job.
That's a good question. I think just, you know, looking after your staff and listening to them and helping them.
Not letting it be a one-way conversation?
Yes.
Are there people you turn to now who help you with moments of needing to be a better boss? People that you go to as your advisors?
Yeah, you know, like my friends, like Anita, and we talk about stuff all the time. It's nice to have those kind of, you know, people that you can just go back and forth with, you know. It's a good gauge to see how you're getting on and how you're coping and whether it's normal what you're thinking or doing.
Have any of your former bosses had a chance to eat at your restaurants here?
Yes, yeah. Rose Gray actually came. I think we'd been open a couple of months, and you know, I spent my first 2 years behind the line, and I was expediting and cooking and trying to teach and doing all the ordering. I mean, I was pretty much working 18 hours a day. And Rose came in, and I think my hair was like this. And I was like flipping my burgers, you know, like really into it. And Rose is like, April! And I'm like...
Never leaves you.
I'm like, oh my God. Anyway, I'm like, it was all good. She loved it. But I was like petrified for a brief second.
I don't know why that made me lose my train of thought. The thought of your hair standing on end. Flipping burgers. Tasty burgers. When you think about expansion now, well, first, will there be more expansion? Is there something in the works?
There might be a few things in the works, mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, well, we'll stop right there. But to be announced, do you think, how do you reconcile your role as a restaurateur versus being a chef now that you are responsible for literally hundreds of people and several restaurants? Does the thought of being a restaurateur and opening more still excite you the way it did?
Right. That's the first time I think anybody's ever called me a restaurateur. But,
well, it's kind of true. I hate to break it to you.
It's kind of...
Sorry.
Freaky.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you run a large business. You employ... Right. You said, I think when we were talking the other day, you said you employ probably 500 people.
So something like that,
that's
yeah.
a major dent in New York's... and San Francisco's economy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people who are then taking care of other people in their own lives, right, who you are making an impact,
right,
on.
Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility. And that's why you have to try and be the best every day. You know, it's not just for myself. It's not just for my own benefits. You know, it's for the people that we employ. You know, we need to make them happy and have a happy life, you know, and be passionate at what they do.
Before we go, I'll ask a few quick questions from people who asked me to ask them of you. Just a few fun things. What's your favorite thing to eat?
My favorite thing to eat is chocolate. I love chocolate. Mm. You know, meat. I love meat. Veggies. I love everything. Actually. Yeah, I'm pretty even keeled. I even ate a cricket once. That was pretty okay.
Deep fried with a little salt?
It's a little cigarette tasting, like, kind of.
What is your...
You know what I wouldn't eat? I wouldn't eat a witchetty grub. You know what those are?
A who to what?
A witchetty grub. They're like these...
A witchetty grub?
Yes.
Oh, like a grub, like a...
Yeah,
a
like
bug.
An Australian. Yeah, I wouldn't eat one of those.
No.
But I eat pretty much everything else.
Good. Open to everything except mm-hmm. grubs. Favorite kitchen tool?
Ooh, I love Mezzaluna. I think those are the most underrated kitchen pieces of kitchen tools ever. Pestle and mortar, I love. Mm-hmm. You know, all those kind of rustic, hearty, old school tools I love. But I am spending a couple of days, I'm taking my chefs to the modernist kitchen, and I'm going to go play around with some of their...
Centrifuge?
Something like that, yeah.
The Mezzaluna and the centrifuge?
I don't even know what's out there, so the possibilities are endless, really, so... Yeah, we'll see.
I think you will be inspired.
I might hit up Dominique Crenn and see if I can hang out first.
If you're nice, maybe she'll let
yeah,
you come.
Right.
Is there any chef you haven't had a chance to work with that you wish you could?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to go hang out with Alain Ducasse or Michel Bras, maybe, you know, some of those kind of Frenchy guys. Just to... Well, their accent's amazing, right? Mm. And
very sexy accents.
And I don't know. It's like, you know, like, I want to go see that stuff. You know, I'm not done yet. There's still much more to learn, and I'm ready.
Yeah. So where's your next vacation?
My next vacation is New Orleans, actually. And
good idea.
I go
I just
on
got
Wednesday.
Back on Monday. Right. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to eat?
I don't know.
Everything.
oysters and, I don't know, beignets.
Have
coffee.
You been before? Have you been
no,
to New Orleans?
My first time.
Oh, you've
yeah,
never
super
been
excited.
To New Orleans yeah. before?
Yeah, drink some cocktails.
Many you know? Cocktails.
Yeah.
And lastly, what if you could... if you could take a dish from home to put on your menu that you haven't before, a dish from your childhood, what would it be?
Well, I do that quite frequently, but faggots, I love faggots. Sorry for saying that. That's not offensive. They're also called duck savouries, and they're actually originated in the Midlands, where I'm from. They're basically like a crepinette. You know, you use the core fat, you stuff it with all the innards or pork belly, and you just grind it all up, and then you cook it in some gravy, a little bit of mashed potato, or some root vegetables would be good. A little bit of greens on the side. Very, very delicious.
And those aren't on your menu?
They're not. They kind of fluctuate, coming on and coming off. They're much more of a fall, wintery thing. And now we're, hopefully past the winter.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Thank you so much,
thank
April.
You.
Thanks yeah, for spending
thank
this time with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.